Hi everyone, Drew Perrott here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. I wanted to give you a little context before we jump in today's interview. Every so often I come across a company that's doing such incredible work to take this field forward that I invite them or a founder or their chief medical officer onto the podcast to talk about what they're up to. And that's what today's episode is. If you care about the topics of depression, anxiety, mental health disorders, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's, suicide and suicide prevention, this interview is for you. I've invited Dr. Eric Wan from Wave Neuroscience to talk about magnetic resonance therapy and something that his team are perfecting that they call e-magnetic resonance therapy. This is an exciting new technology that is really going to take mental health, depression, mood disorders, and brain optimization to the next level. I hope you find it super fascinating. Dr. Eric Wan is a veteran, was previously in the Navy as a surgeon, is a Harvard graduate, like comes with all the pedigree that's there. And if it wasn't for him being the person who's describing this technology that his company is working on and their work with the Department of Defense and other veterans that are out there and CEOs, I would have been so skeptical in terms of what was possible. So if you're interested in the next leap forward in medicine and exciting new technologies to help not only veterans, which by the way, suffer from twice the suicide rate that lay people suffer from, or people that are dealing with depression. If you're interested in any of these topics, this interview is something you're going to absolutely want to hear. Okay, so this was recorded on my iPhone, but the rest of the interview is in HD. So stay tuned. Here is my formal intro for Dr. Eric Wan. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, mindset, and more. I'm your host, Drew Perrott, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Dr. Eric Wan. Dr. Wan is president of Wave Neuroscience, a biotechnology company that has innovated a breakthrough technology called magnetic e-resonance therapy, which we'll be diving deep into in this episode. Dr. Wan joined Wave Neuroscience after serving as the chief physician and chief technology officer for a Fortune 50 aerospace company. Dr. Wan also served as a U.S. Navy flight surgeon for the Marine Medium Helicopter Squadron 268 and received the distinction of serving as the Aviation Combat Element flight surgeon for the 11th Expeditionary Unit. Dr. Wan has been published in numerous peer-reviewed journals, textbooks, and presented in many academic conferences. He completed his residency at the Harvard OEM Combined Residency Program and was appointed chief resident. He received an MPH from Harvard School of Public Health and an MBA from the University of Southern California Marshall School of Business. Dr. Wan, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you so much. Very much an honor to be here.
Before we get into the technology and how your company is servicing lay people and veterans alike, I want to start with a little bit of your origin story. So you initially wanted to become a priest, but later decided to go into medicine and become a flight surgeon in the Navy. How does that happen?
Yeah, so it's funny to think back to that because I'm now happily married with five children. But when I was going to college, myself and a very close friend were considering the seminary. He actually is now a priest. But, you know, for me, as I spent time with the seminarians, I realized this life probably wasn't for me, and I went in a different direction. And my way to give back and serve was going to be through medicine. And, you know, through a variety of different life choices, I ended up serving in the military as a Navy flight surgeon. And yeah, it's been a really fun journey, and I'm very grateful for the experience I've been given.
So you joined the Navy, and you were deployed to the Middle East. Can you talk a little about your experience in the Navy and the impact that it had on your life?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so, you know, I took what's called a health profession scholarship, and initially, the goal was just to unburden myself of the debt of medical school, which is fairly substantial. But what the experience taught me is just the military in general, they're amazing people I had the privilege to serve with, and the dedication, the sacrifice, and the devotion of the group, it really sort of leaves an imprint with you for the rest of your life. And I still keep in touch with so many of my friends with that experience. But you know, I think what most people end up leaving with is it ends up kind of being interwoven into your DNA in some form or fashion. This mindset of service, mission, purpose, because ultimately the jobs that we're all doing serve a purpose greater than ourselves. And so I think that's really kind of fundamental to our existence, even when we leave. I think a lot of the vendors I keep in touch with, we're all sort of mission-driven, purpose-driven, and I think that's part of what draws us to the military.
So piggybacking on that, the unit that you were that you had left in the Middle East had a terrible accident and lost one of their helicopters. Can you talk about that story and the impact that that experience had?
Yeah, so, and you know, these are never comfortable things to talk about, but you know, April 20, 2003, our unit did have a helicopter go down. We lost 16 souls, the British Special Forces, and then our pilots and air crew. It was just an unexpected sandstorm, obliterated the horizon. There's, we believe, a vertigo episode, nose down, and, you know, we lost our aircraft. And really, I think the impact was just the downrange, residual effect of losing friends who you really loved and cared for. And so for the preceding 12 to 15 years, we all kind of leaned on each other. We immersed ourselves in our work. And yeah, it has, I think no matter what, a profound impact on everyone involved. And to this day, I think a lot of us still struggle with the loss. In terms of my experience, it did shape some of my career decisions, moving from, I think, the largest employer in the country, the government, to, you know, finishing up my medical training, going to a Fortune 50 company, and then joining a small biotech startup. I don't think I would have made that leap, unless this was a very personal mission for me. And just having so many friends struggling with conditions like concussion and post-traumatic stress. You know, this particular technology and career pathway resonated with me in a different way. So yeah, we're all sort of shaped by our experiences, and this one had a fairly profound impact on me. And so certainly that life event impacted our whole squadron unit. And so I think we'd all like to think some good came out of it, and that's what we're trying to achieve now.
You know, one of the lowest percentage of Americans that have a family member in the military is kind of where we're at now, you know, compared to, let's say, like 50 years ago or 60 years ago and before that. And so less Americans really know about how difficult and the challenges that the military goes through and service members go through. What is it that you think that people coming out of that experience and being in the military, what do you think is that, I'm sure there's so many things, but what do you think are some of the top couple things that people don't understand about the stress and the pressure of being an active service member?
Oh, that's a great question. And, you know, I think a lot of, and I think there's a lot of proper attention to this now, but transition management is not easy, right?
And going from the military to then now,
exactly. Yeah, transitioning to civilian life, it's not as smooth as I think a lot of us would hope. And I think part of that is the loss of brotherhood and kinship, and you end up sometimes in an isolated environment. You know, a lot of us talk about we end up in situations where you're sort of avoiding, you know, parties or crowds. You become kind of socially avoidant, so to speak. And, you know, part of that is that used to be sort of built into your everyday life, where I think back, if I was having a bad day or a rough clinic, I could go to my squadron, and in the ready room, there are 10 to 20 of my best friends who we could just sit around and joke and talk about things. And that was always built into our work environment. And when you leave, all of a sudden that kinship is gone, right? All the brothers and sisters that you would see every day and work with every day, know, that's all behind you.
And shared such a shared focus and mission and purpose that you all have together.
That's right. And that's the other piece is I think many people when they leave are missing that kind of that element where there's a bigger purpose and a bigger mission. And so I think to a large degree, that's what people are seeking when they get out. And I think there's plenty of people who make a successful transition and do amazing things. And there are others who I think struggle with that transition, and it's not always easy. But yeah, I think that that's a part of it. I think having a skill set to bring to the community and to transition successfully is also part of the challenge. And hopefully, I think that there are programs that are available to veterans, such as the Montgomery GI Bill, where people can get an education and transition. But it's not always so easy for folks to make that transition.
It can be very tough. And there's also other repercussions that can happen, both for the military in general and also for veterans afterwards. You know, one of the things that you're trying to put the spotlight on is at least more part of the lexicon and the understanding that's out there is that suicide is at twice the rate for veterans, and approximately 17 veterans a day die by suicide. And I want to make that connection because that transition process, especially for somebody leaving the military and suffering from all different sorts of ailments, if they are, and loss of kinship, loss of brotherhood, loss of sisterhood, and now trying to figure out where to go next. Is it those things? What are some of the factors that cause us and have us in a place where the suicide rates amongst veterans are twice the average population?
That's a great. It's a very complex question, and I don't pretend to have all the answers or to know. I think it's not really formulaic. I think it's different for every individual. But I think those things that we touched on is this loss of brotherhood or sisterhood, going out into the community, wanting to make an impact, not always knowing a clear pathway towards that is part of the challenge. I think the isolation piece of going from a built-in group of friends and kind of an extended family into maybe not having that kind of access and being around maybe others who don't understand exactly what the military experience was like. Combat environment's fairly unique. It's a very intense environment. And a lot of the research we have on PTSD is really zoning in on what's called autonomic dysregulation, where they end up in a bit of a fight or flight mode that's hard to break out of. And going back into a civilian society that, you know, that same kind of friendship isn't necessarily always there. And you end up in a competitive workplace, maybe back in school, whatever it is. And it poses a whole new set of challenges.
You're basically saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm doing my best to translate it, but obviously, you know, you've lived it firsthand in the experience. So what I'm hearing is that you're basically saying that in a high stress, even if it's not in combat, but definitely in combat, but even if it's around that in a high stress environment, like serving in the military, our system is so wired to be in that fight or flight response. And then you come back to it in a lower stress environment, but it's still wired to that response rate that it had experienced before. Is that a little bit of what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think that's a pretty fair summary. What's interesting, there's, I think, new emerging data coming from the VA. And one of the things that caught me off guard was the highest rate of suicide was actually coming the first 3 years out of service. And so, you know, kind of circling back to that point of this transition from service into civilian life, that can be a bit of a struggle. And all the dynamics that go into that aren't perfectly understood. But I think part of it is when you're in the military, there's a very clear line of where your career path is going to go, what direction you're going to take. And having this kind of open-ended situation where you end up back home and you don't always know which pathway you're going to take, I think that's a clear differentiating factor for a lot of people is if you have a very dedicated pathway that you know you're going to go towards, it's easy to make that switch. But it's not always easy if you're expecting that opportunity to just come and land in your lap. And so one of the things I think these transition programs are focusing on is what is your calling? What's going to be the next step for you?
And how can we as a society, as a greater society, if we're not, you know, for those of us that are not in the military or don't have family members in it, what are the things we can also do to support those individuals in making that transition?
Right. Well, yeah, so it's interesting. I had a vet share with me recently that, you know, this transition happens so fast. And it's kind of, he described it as, you know, a fast-moving car or locomotive that's coming through. And unless you grab on and move with it, you can get left behind. And then all those resources are behind you. And it's really hard to catch up. And so I do think the community is doing a good job of trying to provide those resources for veterans to reach out to and be reintegrated and plugged in. But it's not always easy for folks to reach out and to get plugged into those programs.
So we were talking about suicide and you were really making the link. And I just want to summarize it again because we kind of touched on it very quickly. So is the link that you're making that individuals that the suicide rate is higher amongst those individuals that have experienced that PTSD, that not everybody who has PTSD will, be somebody that commits suicide, but that there's a strong link there that more often individuals who have PTSD are more likely to commit suicide?
Well, I think the data would suggest that it's very multifactorial. And one of the interesting data points, there's something called the polytrauma model, where individuals who are struggling with traumatic brain injury or concussion, chronic pain with opioid use, and then depression or PTSD, that triad of diagnoses and disorders may lend itself towards people who are thinking about self-harm. And so I think identifying the people at risk and trying to do outreach to help them is ultimately one of the higher priorities. And I think whether it's the VA or DOD doctors, everyone is trying to provide the resources that they can to help folks who are struggling with that. But it's not always easy. There aren't necessarily great answers for people who are struggling with those kind of conditions.
Yeah, it's such a complicated topic. And also that calls for the case of finding more emerging technologies that can help people at scale. And that's a lot of the work that you're focused on that we're going to talk about in a minute. So currently, more than 8 million Americans live with some of these symptoms of night terrors, flashbacks, PTSD, not just individuals who are in the military, but other individuals too. And the estimate is that my team member Melanie wrote this down for me, and I just remember reading it and thinking, wow, the estimate is at least 600,000 post 9/11 veterans are part of that population. So what's the current standard of approach for PTSD in terms of the standard of care of treating it?
Sure. Well, so what's interesting, I wasn't necessarily aware of this going into this line of work, but what's interesting is the largest population of people struggling with PTSD are actually sexual assault survivors rather than veterans with combat-related PTSD. And so it's a very broad range of people suffering from the condition. But the current standard of care is a multifactorial approach. And so what the VA endorses is cognitive behavioral therapy as one of the mainstays of treatment. There's cognitive processing therapy, exposure therapy, eclectic psychotherapy, and medication management is focused on these SSRIs, these antidepressants, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. That's come under some scrutiny lately. Some of the side effects of psychopharma are steering people away from leaning on the medications, but I think that they still have their place in certain
Might be cases. Overprescribed is sort of a little bit of the leanings in the conversation that's out there. They still have a place, but they might be a little bit overprescribed right now is the discussion that's happening.
That's exactly right. And there are some data showing folks on these SSRIs can be at increased risk of thoughts of self-harm and suicide. And so it may not be the ideal medication, but nevertheless, many times you want to provide some form of therapy to an individual who's struggling. And so, I think using all the different resources out there, And there's some promising data on other modalities such as eye movement, desensitization or reprocessing, transcendental meditation. Even in 2017, there's some data on hyperbaric oxygen therapy that was fairly promising. And so I think there's emerging technology modalities that can help people on their journey. So, you know, that's we're, I think, growing in terms of what we can offer people who are struggling with these conditions.
It's almost like from afar when I read the headlines and I read the articles, and I love listening to, you know, long format content where they talk about this, because I'm always trying to understand the current state of what's there. It's like the problem has gotten so bad, we need to look for other modalities and solutions that can help in addition to what we currently have, because it wasn't one thing that caused it. So it's probably not going to be one thing that's going to be the fix for it. We need a lot of different options. Pharmaceuticals are one of those options, but there's other options that are available too.
Correct. Yeah. And I think a lot of the more holistic methods may be more appealing to folks instead of leaning for medication management. I think there's something self-empowering about learning transcendental meditation, breathing, mindfulness. These kind of modalities, I think, can help in different ways for individuals. So yeah, I think increasing the awareness that these are alternative remedies that are out there is part and parcel to helping our patients and doing what's best for each one involved.
So let's come back to your story and let's talk about your current role and the work that you're doing at Wave Neuroscience. So let's start from the beginning, which is, what is magnetic e-resonance therapy?
Sure. And so this is a new technology. And you know, I mentioned to you before we started speaking that I was very skeptical of this technology when I first heard about it. And it was one of my pilot friends who had shared with me that this had had quite an impact on him and his outlook. And
so where, set the stage for us. Where were you at the time when you had first heard about it through this friend of yours that was a pilot?
Sure. So I was at the Boeing Company. I was their chief physician, chief technology officer for health services. And you know, we would audit and vet a number of different technologies. And the way it was described seemed a bit too good to be true to me.
And what was your role there? You were focused on taking care of pilots or coming up with protocols to service different groups of, like, what were you doing there that this even got on your radar?
Yeah, so, you know, it was a dynamic role where we would first and foremost take care of patients who were hurt on in the workplace, heavy manufacturing sites, building airplanes or satellites. We would help to take care of them, look for opportunities to prevent injuries, and then work on special projects to minimize risk and exposure, work on the risk management side of the house, and also with our health insurance policies, identifying technologies and medications that we would want to endorse on the group health side. And so that was where I moved into this role, looking at new emerging technologies that we may be interested in adopting. And so hearing about this technology, it of course was of interest, because we've been struggling so long with so many of these conditions with limited options to offer people. And so when my friend came and approached me with it, I agreed to learn more about it. I visited the site, heard about the technology, and kind of started down this road of diligence of figuring out what's the upside, what's the downside, what's the potential.
And before we go into that, what piqued your curiosity? What did your friend share, if you don't mind sharing, or as much as you can share? What did they share was their experience that piqued your interest to even go down the path of making this commitment to investigate the technology?
Well, the first thing he mentioned is that he was getting restful sleep. And foundationally, that struck a chord. And this is back in, 2012, 2013 timeframe. And, you know, sleep sleep is foundational to so many both benefits and sleep deprivation, causing so many different risks. It struck me that this was the first thing he mentioned, was that he was sleeping better. It gave him, perhaps as a byproduct of the more restorative sleep, more emotional resilience. He's able to manage his anger better. He was thinking more clearly. And so all these things were of great interest to me. And so as I went to the center to learn from the scientists, doctors, and engineers there, they explained to me the process. And I started talking to specialists and experts in the area of neuroscience and neurosurgery and neurology. And as we all congregated around the table to learn more about this, there was a realization that this was something that was showing a lot of real promise.
So describe this, because our audience is listening and trying to imagine, and who knows what they're thinking, but it actually does, you know, sound like something out of science fiction. So describe what this is. What is this when you're talking about magnetic e-resonance therapy? Like, what is actually happening to a person? What kind of treatment is this, if you could describe it?
Yeah, so it's really a three-step process. And the first step is to get what's called a quantitative EEG, an electroencephalogram. So this is an electrophysiologic picture of the brain, or brain map, that is giving us very useful information about brain function. And so what we've learned is that everyone has a unique frequency or unique signature. And so all of us during our wakeful hours, we're looking for something called an alpha frequency, where our brain most comfortably operates. And it's basically a cycle rate where we're all somewhere between 8 and 13 hertz. And you might be, for example, an 11.4 hertz brain. I might be an 8.9 hertz brain, and somebody else may be a 10.3 hertz brain. It's just kind of where we're born. But when we get these brain images, whether it's through the physical trauma of a blast injury, or the chemical trauma of years of drug use, or the emotional trauma of seeing a loved one pass away, we may find areas of the brain that are not cycling at the same rate as the rest of our cortex. And so
I'm just going to pause right there, because mm-hmm. that right there is already huge for people. This idea that trauma is not just an internal, ethereal, emotional thing, but there's actual parts of the brain that you can see that it had an impact on.
That's right. And I think that's fundamentally even part of the healing process. We hear so many times from a patient or a veteran that, geez, you know, there's something, you know, that I can look at that's showing me this is not operating as well as it can.
It's not all in my head, but it is actually physically in your head. And that gives people a sense of relief and understanding.
That's right. And so, you know, there's different tools and different imaging technologies for different purposes. And MRIs and CT scans are wonderful. You know, the gold standard of neuroimaging is great at telling us anatomic derangement, but doesn't tell us quite as much about function, whereas these EEGs, electrical pictures of the brain, can tell us when there's abnormalities in neural networks.
And that's compared to, so if I got a brain scan done, it would be looking at, compared to like a healthy brain,
how
would this be firing on all cylinders? Okay, this region of your brain has lower activity, so we know that something is up. Is that what you're...
That's right. And so we run that data through a normative database, and we can see, for example, if somebody has an area in the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that's cycling at 2 hertz, which means, you know, that may be only processing information 2 times per second, whereas the rest of your brain may be cycling 11 times per second. That information mismatch may manifest for somebody as depression. They may lack motivation, feel lethargic, not want to get out of bed. But in a different scenario, if the area that is not working properly, let's say, is a visual cortex that's cycling now at 30 times per second. If you're scanning your environment 30 times per second, but only able to process it 10 or 11 times per second, this information overload may manifest as anxiety. And it's not a one-to-one correlation. Everyone experiences their world a little bit differently. And I don't want to misrepresent all of this, because...
it's almost like it's an indication that something is up.
Right. And so
there's a lot more complexities that are there.
Correct. But nobody has a perfect brain, right? Sure. And so I think if people come in wanting to see everything is firing harmoniously all together all the time, you know, that's not the case. You know, we react to different situations and different stressors a little bit differently. But for the most part, we can look at these signals and find areas that are abnormal, and which is our third step, is to use this FDA clear technology, transcranial magnetic stimulation, navigate to the area that's not working properly and try to stimulate it and remind it that it wants to fire at a certain frequency and a certain rate.
And so that third step, what does that visually look like? So our listeners can get an idea, you know, what's happening? Is the patient sitting down? Are they standing up? Are you putting something on their head? Like, what's actually going on in that third step?
Yeah, so it's a very benign procedure. You're sitting in a comfortable chair. It's actually effortless. And there's a 1.5 Tesla magnetic coil that, you know, there's basically a figure eight wand that will put close to your scalp. Mm-hmm. And it will give you about 6 seconds of stimulation that you'll hear just a repeated click. And then
through a magnet.
Through a magnet.
A magnetic coil.
A magnetic coil. That's exactly right. And then there's 54 seconds of rest. And what threw me off a little bit is the magnet part, because, you know, we think about these little trinkets and things that wouldn't really be medical grade. But what's interesting, the first order principles of physics that we're using are that this coil can actually deliver an evoked potential across a solid object like your skull. So it's actually able to deliver energy to your cerebral cortex using a magnet. So magnets have these unique properties that can allow you to stimulate your cortex at a prescribed rate. And that was why this technology was chosen. So it's a non-invasive, non-pharmaceutical form of treatment that we're able to use precision-guided treatment based on the EEG algorithms that we see on the brain map. And so taking that extra step, a lot of what is happening is these transcranial magnetic stimulation devices are fixed at 10 hertz. And that is, if you were to look at the bell curve of population, most of the population would be at the fat part of that curve at 10 hertz. And so if you were to reverse engineer it, that would be the right choice. But I don't know that it necessarily honors our biodiversity, where there are people who may be fast processors at 11 or 12 hertz, or they may be more creative minds at 8 or 9 hertz. And if we are able to deliver treatment at those frequencies, we might be able to get better results and see improved outcomes.
So let's take a step back. So what's the mechanism of how this actually works? So this stimulation, you're scanning the brain, and then you're going through this process to figure out at what level can you stimulate that person's brain for what's going on in their activity, right? Using this magnet. What is the magnet doing to the brain?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The magnet, it's not doing anything. And so just to be clear, in terms of the experience, this is nothing like electroconvulsive therapy that you may have seen in the past.
Yeah, it's not like shock therapy or anything like that.
No,
this is like a very chill process.
Right, right. And it's, you know, there are gentle pulses that are delivered. And functionally what's happening is we're reminding the brain where it wants to be, where it's most comfortable. And so it's sort of tapping into our natural biological mechanism. You know, Mother Nature engineered us as healing organisms, and whether it's putting two ends of a broken bone together, allowing it to heal, two ends of a wound margin together, allowing it to heal. You know, in this case, sometimes our brains will get stuck in a frequency that's not comfortable at, and for whatever the reason may be, we're just giving it that friendly reminder that you want to go back to 10.8 hertz or 9.4 hertz and giving it that stimulation where it can move back. And over time, if we get EEGs every week, every 2 weeks, we can start seeing these changes. And then the body does most of the work for you. So we're not trying to overpower the brain with you know, really high-powered stimulus. It's more of just a general reminder of where the brain needs to go, and then the body does a lot of the work for us.
It's so fascinating. I mean, even though it's a very relaxed process, just hearing you talk about it, it really does sound like science fiction. And even you were sharing earlier, pre-interview, that you were so skeptical about this process. At what point in time did the skepticism fade and you thought, wow, I want to be a part of getting this technology and the science out there to more individuals?
Yeah. So after, my first friend had come in and shared with me his experience, I did end up sending another friend who was really struggling, and he sustained multiple injuries, underwent a back surgery, and was a faithful Marine and had done everything the VA had asked him to do, and at one point was on 20 different medications. And when he reached out to me, I asked him to go try this therapy and see what it could do for him. And even though he was a close friend and I knew he was telling me the truth, it sort of defied traditional medical belief to see what kind of change he was experiencing.
And this individual, he had tried to commit suicide.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's why he had reached out to me, is he had tried everything out there and nothing was really working for him. And I didn't know whether this was going to work either. It was kind of a Hail Mary to see whether this would work or not. But, I spoke to his VA doctors. We spoke at length, and I wanted to give it a try and see what it might do for him.
You talked to his doctors prior to sending him there?
Correct.
And did they, you're a Harvard-trained doctor, you were in the military, but did you get any pushback, even back then, of... like, what the heck are you sending him for?
Surprisingly, there was openness. And I think that the way I think we need to approach this is we're all on the same team. We're all working towards the same goal and trying to serve our patients the best way that we can. And if certain approaches aren't working and there's an alternative approach, in this particular case, the side effect profile wasn't excessive.
There's not a lot to lose.
That's right. And so we gave it a try. And really within about 2 weeks, he came back and shared a similar story about how he got his first night of restful sleep in years.
That's incredible.
And the other interesting data point was his wife coming into the clinic in tears, giving the staff a hug, saying, "You gave me my husband back. This is the man I married 10 years ago." And it sort of dawned on me that there's really something here. And I sent in a second Marine and a third Marine, and we're seeing these fairly consistent results. And ultimately, my ask of the group was, we need to see some really good academically rigorous data on this. And so they launched a trial in San Diego. They saw fairly promising results. At 2 weeks, about a 40% reduction in symptoms of both post-traumatic stress and concussion using a metric called the PCLM, the Post-Traumatic Checklist Military, and the Rivermead Post-Concussion Questionnaire. And that was pretty exciting. And so we came to a crossroads as we were kind of walking through this. There are more and more people getting involved, and there's a Navy SEAL Command Master Chief who kind of cornered me and put his finger in my chest and really challenged me and said, "What do you stand for, brother? You're going to stay at a Fortune 50 company the rest of your life and take care of snotty executives, or are you going to get in the trenches and try to help a lot more people?" And
because at that point you were still sort of on the fence. There's this emerging thing, but there's always risk going with a new company and a startup, and what are the people going to think? And he challenged you, and ultimately,
that's right. And so it was daunting. It's going from a really comfortable position to a small biotech where there's risk. That was a big challenge, but what he said resonated with me. And as I spoke to my wife, she'd mentioned, "This is all you're talking about. This is all you're thinking about. You should consider it." Decided to make that leap about four and a half, 5 years ago. And, one of our first efforts was to launch a much more robust, high-grade clinical trial in collaboration with the Department of Defense and Special Operations Command. And I'm blinded to the data. I don't have access to it, but we are at a stage now where we're looking into expanding it to new sites and trying to get to our primary endpoint just a little bit faster. And we're about a year, depending on how recruitment goes, we're about a year away from being able to unblind those results. But we're cautiously optimistic about the trends, and hopefully we'll be able to help out a lot more people.
So coming back, you know, you have your experience in the military and you send many of your other friends and colleagues who were suffering were also from the military using this technology. But it's not just for military members, of course, and it's not just for people who have suffered PTSD. There are other applications in this technology. What are some of those other applications that could be out there?
That's correct. And so really this was engineered to be a brain optimization technology where we're trying to increase the coherence that different areas of the brain can communicate with each other and improve the efficiency, the metabolic efficiency of the brain. And so with that in mind, we do see some improvements across a number of different dimensions. And so we've seen some improvement and some promising results in autism. We've seen some changes really in kind of this human performance realm where people who may want a competitive edge, whether it's in the executive boardroom or on the athletic field, they may come in for what they're calling a tune-up. And we've seen some interesting results there as well. I'll rewind a little bit. There's something that I didn't mention.
Please.
That what we're getting right now, we can, all these protocols are done manually. We have an EEG lab, we have EEG technicians, and then we have both a senior scientist and a neurosurgeon who design the protocols for each individual. We have designed a software platform that can automate those protocols, where we can now, rather than doing these manually by hand, hopefully push this out in a much larger scale. And that's what we're trying to get FDA approved, is actually the automation of this rather than the manual process. And so,
and to get that approval, what does it take? Is that the trial that you're going through right now?
That's the clinical trial. That's right. And we'll probably need some companion trials to ultimately secure an approval. But, you know, we've taken this first step of really doing rigorous third-party trials with high-grade scientists, engineers, and professionals, and trying to see what those results show us. Because ultimately, the data may lead us in different directions, and it illuminates other areas that we need to research. So, yeah, we're excited to see what this will show, and I think that's coming pretty soon.
So these trials need to be done, but already anecdotally, you've seen firsthand experience through the individuals that have come into the different clinics that you partner with and your friends and service, former service members that have gone and sought out the technology. So yes, the data has to happen and be there to get the FDA approval. Let's imagine for a second that happens. What's the highest expression of this technology that you imagine? Like, how does this change our approach to treating some of the conditions we've been talking about on the podcast?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think there's a variety of different areas that we would like to explore and conduct research on, but the areas anecdotally where we see some promise are with autism. We're about to embark on another trial with stroke.
Stroke patients.
What's interesting is in terms of those who are experiencing some cognitive decline, whether it's Alzheimer's, dementia, or others, we see some improvement in some of their cognitive function measured by an MMSE, which is kind of a crude measure of memory. We're trying to study with some more robust batteries of tests, but because these are neurodegenerative disorders, we don't see lasting benefit with those groups. So we're starting to put some work and effort into creating a home unit. And it's difficult to get the same kind of effect you can get with you know, a larger device, but something to provide maintenance so that these groups don't slide back so quickly, I think would be the goal. And so as people come in for some of these other conditions, if we can get them to a status where they are improving better and then have a home device that they can use so that they don't slide back, that'd be a wonderful adjunct to do. And we're just starting down that road and hoping to see some good product development.
How is this part of the bigger body of topics or modalities that are related around optimizing the brain? Like, where does it fit in the context of food, better sleep? You know, help us, you know, can it work in conjunction with those things?
Yeah, I think that this this works really well in this, in kind of this emerging functional medicine, integrated medicine model. And if you think about these paradigms, whether it's, you know, improving nutrition, exercising, sleeping better, and, you know, this concept of connectedness, one of the things we know we do fairly predictably, if we can improve people's sleep, the quality of people's sleep and more restorative sleep, the downrange benefit of that can be fairly significant. And so in one of our initial pilot studies, we measured something called the PSQI, the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, and we were able to see significant differences in people who are getting sham treatment and people who are getting real active treatment. And what we're trying to explore now is actually doing in-lab polysomnograms and measuring specifically the types of changes that we're seeing, whether it's just changes in latency of sleep, are they getting more stage three, stage four sleep? And in our first foray of data, we are seeing higher quality sleep in terms of the amount of stage three, stage four sleep people are getting after a course of treatment. And we've seen now with emerging data on the glymphatic system and how deep sleep, the restorative properties of sleep, clearing, for example, beta amyloid and tau proteins. And
right. And if you wouldn't mind, I mean, we've done a few episodes on this topic, but just recap for our listeners here, what's the glymphatic system and why is it so important in the brain?
Right. And so there's a Danish researcher by the name of Maiken Nettergaard, who I think is just a brilliant mind. And what she found is that these structures in the brain, previously thought to be just connective tissue, these glial cells, turn out to have a very unique and important role for the brain. And ultimately, what's been found is that it's sort of a sanitation clearance system where every night when we go to sleep, and specifically stage three, stage four sleep, the glial cells tend to diminish in size and open up channels where cerebral spinal fluid can come through the channels and clear out the metabolic waste of oxidative stress. And
so our brain's detoxification system.
That's exactly right. And what's interesting is there were separate studies recently out of Washington University where they found if you just sleep deprive somebody, even one night, and then you do a lumbar puncture to measure the amount of some of these byproducts in the cerebral spinal fluid, there's a dramatic increase in the beta amyloid and tau you can find in the CSF after just one night of sleep deprivation.
So one night of not having good quality sleep. And of course, a lot of people, like young parents, especially young mothers, so many other individuals that are in these situations, so sleep deprived, but that metabolic waste kind of stays in the brain.
That's right. And so then you start thinking about people who are chronically sleep deprived. How is this impacting them and causing more phosphorylation of these beta amyloid and tau proteins and resulting in tauopathy? And you realize the fundamental importance of not just the duration of sleep, but the quality of sleep is critical to allow this glymphatic system to engage and to clear your system. So it turns out now so much of the research on Alzheimer's and cognitive decline has been focusing on, are we producing too much of these proteins? And it turns out it may be more the clearance mechanism that we need to focus on is poor clearance of these proteins. And so what we start thinking towards is, as a preventative measure or even prodromal, if we can get to people and enable them to get more stage three, stage four sleep. And to be clear, it doesn't have to be our technology. It can be a re-emphasis on very good sleep hygiene. And one of the things we always emphasize is the importance of honoring our biology and the circadian rhythm that we're all, you know, thousands of years of our ancestors, our circadian rhythm was established by getting blue light in the morning. So this very specific frequency, 400 to 500 nanometers of blue light, when it hits your retina, suprachiasmatic nucleus, and then ultimately it sends a message to your pineal gland to suppress melatonin until 12 to 14 hours later.
Right, so it's like waking up first thing in the morning and getting like some sun exposure.
That's right.
Or there are some like light therapy units that you can purchase that sort of recreate that if somebody's in a place that is not very sunny or very dark early in the morning.
That's correct. But it is hard to replicate Mother Nature. And so even these indoor blue lights that you use, just to give you an idea, on a sunny day outside, you may be getting 70,000 lumen of blue light.
Right.
Indoors with a blue spectrum light, you may be getting 7,000 lumen, and that degrades exponentially over distance. And so you're not getting as much of it. It's better than nothing. Don't get me wrong.
So the best way, just turn it practical. I know we're talking big picture here. The best way is for people to wake up and go outside and kind of look at the sunrise?
That's exactly right. Whether it's taking the dog for a walk in the park or having a bowl of cereal outside, just getting natural filtered sunlight. And the other part that's interesting, we've learned that glass tends to filter out the intensity of light. So whether you're behind the glass in your car or whether you're in an office, even if you're getting sunlight that's being filtered through glass, you're not getting the blue light spectrum that you need. And so I was thinking, even for myself, when this was first being shared with me, you know, I go from my bedroom down to my car, I'm immediately behind glass, I'm driving to my office and maybe walking 20 feet into the office, I'm getting almost no blue light. And Ambien and all of these blockbuster drugs, it's no wonder, you know, we're living in a society where working at computers is ubiquitous, and there is a certain amount of blue light deprivation that I think a lot of our population is struggling with. And the converse is true too. You know, if we're getting too much blue light at night, that's sending the wrong biological cue to our system,
which is coming from our devices.
That's right.
Or super bright lights in the house or in the bathroom that are overstimulating us and getting the not allowing us to create that melatonin production, which helps us sleep well.
That's precisely right. And I think we're getting smarter. A lot of these devices now have a blue light filter that turns on at a certain time of night, but you're still getting that emotional stimulation. And so I think years from now, we'll look back at this and think, remember that time when we were on our phones and on our tablets and that up to 9 and 10 at night? And really, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice, and we have to put down the screen time. At least I would suggest 4 to 5 hours before we're going to sleep so that our body can work its natural circadian rhythm and get those cues so that we can get more restful sleep. And really, I think as long as that's a point of emphasis where we're being vigilant to protecting our sleep and taking care of ourselves, ultimately from a wellness perspective, I think that should be the goal. And it's not easy. I'm kind of the worst people at listening to my own advice because I'm on my phone more than I should be. But yeah, if there's one message I think for the audience is, number one, getting a good amount of blue light in the morning, roughly 30 minutes to an hour, and then trying to reduce blue light exposure at night, turning off our phones and our tablets, and at the first sign of nighttime somnolence, usually sometime between 9 and 10 o'clock, if you're yawning and you're feeling sleepy, that is very likely when you're having the melatonin spike and you need to go to bed. And if you do that, you may get into stage 3, stage 4 sleep very quickly.
And so zooming out and kind of going big picture, talking about whether somebody's looking for optimization or healing from trauma or healing from a concussion or healing from PTSD or in the process of healing from all those things, sleep is so critical because it's part of the mechanism that allows the brain to heal and repair itself. And in many of those conditions that people are dealing with, they're not getting good quality stage, the different stages that you talked about, that good quality deep stage sleep, so it's harder to heal. And then for anybody interested in optimization, sleep is key. So the connection that you're making that I'm hearing is definitely like a technology of yours, the technology that the company has put out there is one of the tools to do it. But even if people are just listening at home, prioritizing sleep is so important to the body's process of healing.
That's correct. And if you were to, I mean, even not to digress into a huge academic debate, but if you were to look at some of these pillars of functional medicine and wellness, if we're talking about diet and exercise and sleep, I would make the argument that sleep is our most important pillar, is foundational, because you look at, if you listed a top 5 or top 10 issues that are leading to morbidity and mortality in our populations, whether it's cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, insulin resistance, sleep is foundational to all of those. And it's also free, right? And so if you can reduce your rate of cognitive decline, if you can improve your cardiovascular health, your cerebrovascular health, if you can even the number of car accidents that people experience, if we're getting better sleep, all those things are downrange benefits of it. That would be, I think, of critical importance. And I think your audience probably, hopefully knows that. I know it's something that's being hammered.
We all need a reminder.
Yeah. But yeah, I would say that really needs to be a point of emphasis every day that we're working. And yeah, that would be my take-home message.
So we've also done some episodes on concussions and traumatic brain injury. And you were sharing with us previously, and I'd love to expand it on here, on the podcast while we're taping, you're talking about that there seems to be emerging evidence in the difference of how concussions and traumatic brain injury can sometimes lead to structural damage and functional damage. Can you talk about the difference and why that's important?
Yeah, so I'm glad that you brought this up. And we talked about the glymphatic system previously, and I want to touch on, there's separate lines of research, and I think there's starting to be unifying principles beginning to emerge where I want to highlight the research of Ann McKee in Boston and Daniel Pearl at Uniformed Services University, where we're now seeing, at even at a cellular microscopic level, Ann did this famous study of 111 NFL players when they did neuropathology on their brains. She was finding CTE, and the structural area that was damaged was the glial and astroglial cells. So the sanitation system seems to be the specific structure that's being damaged. And Daniel Pearl separately in his neuropathology lab was seeing the same thing. And they're slightly different areas. What Daniel Pearl highlighted was at the interjunctional spaces where cerebral spinal fluid may touch the cortex and where gray matter turns to white matter, because veterans are being injured more with blast injuries and waveform injuries. We're starting to see specific areas of the brain that are getting damaged. But in both cases, it's specifically the astroglial and glial cells that are being damaged. And so it shouldn't be surprising that we're seeing commonalities between all these populations. And I think what we're finding is that the brain responds to insult the same way, right? And so whether it's chronic sleep deprivation, whether it's the mechanical head injury of head-to-head contact, repeatedly on a football field, or whether it's being exposed to repeated blast injuries in the military, or just direct contact with IEDs, the brain seems to be responding to these injuries the same way. And some of these symptoms, we're starting to see coalescence of these symptom clusters as well, that there's memory loss, that there's sleep deprivation. And so all these things are starting to cluster in a way where the emerging science is leading us in a certain direction.
And what do you think the takeaway is, right? For the person that's listening on the podcast here, what's the takeaway for them to understand that they're all pointing at similar things, and it seems like there's a lot of parallels between these different insults in the brain? What's the takeaway for the audience?
Well, I think there's multiple takeaways. One is, I think there's hope, you know? And so I think for so many years now, there's been this feeling of helplessness that concussions are just a fact of life and there's not a lot that we can do. I think we're starting to get down to, at a foundational level, the root cause mechanisms of injury, which will lead us down the pathway of finding solutions.
Because just because we have a name for the disease that somebody's experiencing or the symptoms they have doesn't mean we know why it's happening in the first place. Like, we, even in the sense of a concussion, yes, you might have realized there was impact or a hard hit for somebody who's playing football, but we don't know exactly what it's damaging. And when you don't know exactly what it's damaging and all the things that are affected, you can't come to a solution.
That's correct. And so if we're trying to understand this better on a cellular and molecular level, we can then start engineering therapeutics that may be able to help towards those ends. And that lines up with your question about functional versus anatomical changes in the brain. And we know from neuroimaging studies with repeated injury, you can have certain areas of scar tissue that start to emerge. What doesn't always show up is you can have a pretty healthy looking MRI and a terrible looking EEG or electrophysiologic picture of the brain. And so that's part of what I think is exciting about emerging technology, is if we can now baseline somebody and monitor them over time and see how these injuries are occurring, and have some of these honest conversations of, you know, we're seeing these changes. Can we talk about what we might do to intervene? I think that is of great interest because we might be able to capture people before they fall off the proverbial cliff and impart changes before or preventative measures before it becomes more serious. And I don't want to, I guess, overpromote or misrepresent the technology, but if we can now start restoring some of the neural networks and the damage that we're seeing through neuromodulation, that would really be a disruptive change to the industry. And so what our hope is to advance the science to be able to show and demonstrate changes in people who are struggling with persistent post-concussion syndrome. If we can ameliorate some of the symptoms, afford people more restorative sleep, that could, I think, both help people struggling with current symptoms, but perhaps down the road we can explore what can this do to prevent people from declining and perhaps, you know, even at the preventative stages of disease progression, from a wellness and optimization perspective, could this be something that we look at to help those populations?
And I know, you know, you have to be very cautious about how it's all presented, but I'm just like listening to this as an individual and just like an average consumer who's fascinated about this. But if there was a drug that could do those things, or at least some of the things that you're noticing right now from the patients that are coming in, I mean, that'd be a multi-billion dollar company, right? So it's like we're talking about it in a very academic way, and you have to, and I totally get it. And I'm just, this is my own comments that are being interjected into it, is that this is so exciting, right? This is so exciting about the future and the hope for, as you had mentioned, even if somebody's not dealing with a concussion, emotional insults to the body. Somebody, you know, now with the Me Too movement and so many more people opening up about being sexual assault survivors, you know, rape survivors, and all the other things that come in there, the emotional impact, having physical implications inside of the brain and having the brain not work appropriately. If there was other tools in addition to therapy that were out there, in addition to medication, I mean, this would be a game changer.
Yeah, and I think part of the value proposition with neuromodulation is that it's non-pharmaceutical, it's non-invasive. We can be very directed using, I think, pretty sophisticated algorithms and precision medicine to try to help people. And that, I think, is where a lot of the excitement is. When we start incorporating machine learning, heuristics, artificial intelligence into the database, we have now over 30,000 EEGs, pre and post treatment. What can we do down the road? I think that is where I start to get really excited. And that's a whole other geek session to get into. But I think we're just on the front end of what's possible. And whether it's us or whether it's somebody else that's out there on the market, I think that the science is advancing at such a pace that these solutions are going to start coming to the forefront. And, you know, this message of hope that I would give to your audience is, you know, there is a lot being done. Sometimes it feels like we're moving glacially slow because it's such a pressing need. But there's a lot of, I think, fascinating science that's starting to emerge, and a world of opportunity and potential to help vulnerable populations find answers. And so I would just suggest keep looking for answers. Don't give up. Advocate for yourself, whether it's eating better, exercising smarter, protecting your sleep, do all of those things. And, you know, everyone keep advancing the best way that they can. We're certainly working as fast as we can on the technology side.
So going back to the technology, you know, you gave amazing pearls of wisdom and why we should prioritize sleep. But also one of the main reasons we've had you on here is that when I had first heard about your technology, I thought this has to be one of the tools in people's toolbox that they can at least explore to see if it's a right fit for them. So for somebody who's listening to this and is like, whoa, this is super interesting, where can listeners go to see if they're a good fit, and what clinics have the technology right now?
So I'll say this. Our company is called Wave Neuroscience. We're the biotechnology company. We're licensing the technology to other business partners and licensees. And we've been fairly deliberate and disciplined in how we're growing. We're not just growing for the sake of growth. We're trying to partner with best-in-class business partners. And you can see a listing of some of our centers at braintreatmentcenter.com. That's one of our licensees.
And these are different clinics that do a lot of stuff, but in including to what they do, they offer, also offer your technology that we were talking about.
That's correct. And, you know, locally, you know, we're actually recording this in Los Angeles. We're with the Colonel and Job Sports Medicine Group, an affiliate of Cedars-Sinai. Dr. Vernon Williams is our contact there. We have centers in Newport Beach and San Diego, in Texas and Dallas, as well as EnterHealth. We have a center in Miami. We're growing centers in D.C. So we're looking to expand our footprint, but we want to do it in a very strategic manner. One other initiative I want to mention is we received a very generous donation from two groups, the Tomahawk Charitable Foundation and the Special Operations Care Fund, SOCF, to treat Special Operations veterans through our center in San Diego. So if there's anybody who this might apply to, if there's any veteran operators out there, please consider visiting braintreatmentcenter.com/collaboration, and we'd be honored to take care of you. It's been our privilege to be involved in that capacity, and we're always happy to take care of those who served.
Super important, and we'll make sure to have a link for all those inside the show notes. If you're listening on YouTube, also just look below into the caption section, and you can find the show notes over there. What do you think of looking back now? How long has it been at the Wave Neuroscience for yourself?
Well, so this is actually a new company, but I've been with the technology for about 5 years, and yeah, it's been a kind of a wild ride to see how everything has transpired, and I wouldn't have it any other way. But
so I'm gonna ask you an immigrant question. When you talk to your parents about what you do, what do you say? Well, that's a universal question, but it's a classic thing of me going to parties as now a podcast host and an entrepreneur in so many different businesses. You know, is the standard question of like, what do you do? So how do you answer that for your family?
Yeah, so our technology ultimately is computational neuroanalytics that's helping us to...
Already lost me if I'm at a family party. If I'm at a cocktail party, you're the most fascinating person there for sure.
Oh, not at all. But yeah, we're ultimately trying to optimize brain performance, brain function, and we're utilizing a technology to both guide precision medicine protocols and to improve quality of life, give people the opportunity to be the best versions of themselves. And that's kind of our goal, is to innovate technologies in service of a better life.
One additional question that I wanted to ask is that, have you tried the technology? And if so, what have you noticed for yourself?
I did. It's interesting. So this is part of, you know, I mentioned earlier, some of my barriers of skepticism. I did want to try and demo the technology. And like many physicians, I was a terrible patient. But I went in and I did immediately notice that I was getting higher quality sleep. When I was waking up, I was feeling more alert and awake. And it wasn't as profound a change for me as it may have been for some others, but that was kind of the epiphany of, you know, if all of my patients feel this way, I would love for them to experience this, because I did feel like it was, you know, it wasn't something where I was a different person, but I felt like I was operating much more efficiently than I was prior to treatment.
So that was your experience. Lastly, like all things that are out there, are there any risks? Are there any side effects with the technology?
Of course, yeah. And so our technology, specifically the transcranial magnetic stimulation portion, does come with some common side effects. So the most common side effect we see with our technology, specifically the transcranial magnetic stimulation portion, is there can be a transient episode of headache, usually alleviated by over-the-counter ibuprofen or Tylenol. There can be episodes of vertigo. There can be a feeling of euphoria or overstimulation. The most significant risk that we touch on with all of our patients is there can be episodes of seizure. And we've not, in our clinic, seen a de novo episode of seizure, but it is a risk that we see with the TMS. But to put a benchmark around that, the numbers that are typically mentioned are a 1 in 10,000 or greater risk of seizure. And many of the products that we see, I'm thinking specifically of Nintendo Game Boy, those brochures list a risk of seizure of 1 in 4,000. So even though there is a risk that we observe, the safety profile is still fairly good. But we always want to be very transparent about the risks and the side effects. And so those are things that we always talk about.
Amazing. And at the clinics that are there that you mentioned earlier that we have in the show notes, they can talk about it with a qualified healthcare practitioner to see where they stand with those risk and any questions that they have.
That's right. So there's an intake with every patient. We go through safety questionnaires, and there's a lot of safety protocols built into the treatment. And just to give you an example, a lot of the transcranial magnetic stimulation technologies are doing what's called a motor threshold at 120%. So you find out what level of stimulation is required to evoke a twitch in somebody's contralateral thumb, for example. We're a sub-threshold technology, and so precision matters more for us. And so we'll find that motor threshold, but we'll go to 80% or 60% of motor threshold, understanding that the amount of energy or the power being delivered isn't necessarily the important part for us. It's about being precise about what frequency of stimulation that we're delivering.
Dr. Eric Wan, thank you so much for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast and talking about what you guys are up to. It's very rare that we just have a company come on here and talk about and share. But when it comes to emerging technology, especially people that are going through the rigor of science, it's so hopeful for our audience, and it gives them possibilities, especially when somebody's suffering so much and there's a potential technology or tool that's out there that has, you know, little to no side effects that are there. The only thing, I mean, what do you have to lose when you're looking for the next solution that can potentially help you on your journey? So thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your wisdom with our audience.
Oh, it's my privilege and honor. Thank you for taking the time.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.